but I'm going to do a guided meditation. If you'd rather just meditate on your own, you're welcome to just turn off the sound and go for it. It's going to be till 6 o'clock, 4 o'clock SL time. So another 27 minutes. So meditation, Buddhist meditation ideally is a study of reality, but it's also an ethical study of reality. So we're not just concerned with reality for reality's sake. We're concerned with understanding reality so it helps us to cultivate what we call ethics, Buddhist ethics. Now Buddhist ethics are a bit specific in that we're not interested in ethics for ethics' sake either. We're only interested in ethics because it leads to peace and happiness and freedom from suffering. So we're not interested in being good little boys and girls just because that's what the Buddha told us to do. But we're interested in cultivating states of mind that bring us peace, happiness, and freedom from happiness, freedom from suffering. Yeah. So the theory goes that this is this is a form of ethics, that actually, even though it sounds quite selfish and self-serving, it actually, the way it plays out in reality is in the most ethical way possible, that you're search for peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering leads you to become more and more ethical in some sense of the word that may or may not be held by other religious traditions. The point being that we become better people for ourselves and at the same time become better people for the world, for those around us. A person can't find peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering while causing suffering for others. So this is what we mean by meditation, to find peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering based on the cultivation of reality-based ethics, or ethics that is based on direct observation of what brings peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. So we're going to look at reality. We're going to try to understand our own experience in terms of how it's bringing us peace or how it's bringing us suffering, how we're causing suffering for ourselves. We start by looking at our own physical manifestation, the body. Look at the sensations that arise in the body, whether they be heat or cold or hardness or softness, stiffness or so on. Any any sort of sensation in the body, we begin our exploration by studying our physical manifestation. Not because we're really all that interested in the physical. Actually, it sounds kind of meaningless. But because we're interested in the mental, we're interested in how our mind reacts to things. And because the best place or the best way to study the mind is to study the body. If you want to find a person, the best, most likely place you're going to find them is in their home. If you want to find the mind, the best place to look for it is in the body. And it's even clearer than that. When you begin to look at the body, it's actually the mind which is looking at the body. And so you're going to get a first-hand look at how you react to experience, to simple physical experience. Take something very simple. The easiest one, because it's always there, is the stomach rising and falling. When you breathe in, if you put your hand on your stomach, you can feel it rising. And when the breath goes out, you can feel it falling. So just repeat to yourself, rising, falling, rising, falling. Just repeat the word in your mind to keep yourself with the experience. And what's going to happen is you're going to see how your mind reacts to experience. If you can't find the rising and falling, or if you really don't want to focus on it, there are other things you can focus on: the sitting posture, the feelings in the back and the bottom, and your feet touching the floor and so on. And you can focus on the heat and the cool feelings that arise at the nose when the breath goes in and out. Saying to yourself, feeling, feeling, or hot, hot, or cold, cold, whatever. The point is that we're going to see how our mind works. The first thing that you're going to see that arises in the mind is some sort of feeling based on the experience. Maybe it's a painful feeling, or maybe it's a pleasant feeling, or maybe it's a calm feeling. And so this is the next thing we focus on, is the feelings that arise based on our experience. So you're watching the stomach or whatever, and you feel pain, maybe in the head, maybe in the back, maybe in the bottom or in the legs or wherever. Normally this would be a source of suffering for us. We think to ourselves, this is the cause of suffering, painful feeling. Because we don't really understand what's going on, we attribute the suffering as an intrinsic aspect of the pain, but the pain is not really what's making us suffer. Our attachment to the pain, our dislike of the pain, is in fact something different from the pain itself, and is the true culprit, the true cause of our pain, of our suffering. So we focus on the pain and say to ourselves, pain, pain. Just look at it as pain, see it for what it is. Study it, see what's going on there. What's really causing you suffering? If you feel happy, say to yourself, happy, happy. Normally a happy feeling, we think, well, this is the cause of happiness, right? It's happiness. And so we cling to it. We look for it. We crave for it. Well, guess what? It's not really going to make us happy. If we're not mindful of it, if every time we sit, when we experience a happy feeling, we crave it, we cling on to it, then we'll only find our ordinary lives all the more disappointing. And whenever we sit and meditate and don't experience these happy states, we'll be disappointed. There's nothing wrong with happiness, but there's nothing wrong with pain either. So we're trying to understand this. We're trying to be able to see what's really going on. When you see the happiness for what it is, you don't judge it, even as a good thing. You don't cling to it. When you feel calm, just the same. Rather than cultivating this partiality towards the experience, we learn to just see the experience for what it is. Calm, calm, just reminding ourselves. The next thing we'll see, of course, is the thoughts. I bet not many of us are able to keep thoughts out of our minds while we do this. Probably while you're listening to me and trying your best to follow along, there's lots and lots of thoughts coming up, taking you out of the present moment, taking you into the past, taking you into the future. Distracting, evil, bad, you know? Thoughts are a bad thing, right? We should try to be free from thought, because it's bad. Meditation should be without thought, right? Well, not really, actually. Thought's not a bad thing at all. Thought's just thought. So there's something else in there. It's not the thought that's causing us the suffering. Thought is just thought. Where does the bad come from? This is what we're looking for. Focus on the thought. Say to yourself, thinking, thinking. See what's really going on. finally we see there's something yet more beyond even thought, and that's our emotions, our judgments, our likes, our dislikes, our fears, our worries, our doubts, our confusions, our distractions. And we say, maybe it's this, maybe this is what's really behind all this mass of suffering. Maybe it's not the body, maybe it's not the feelings, maybe it's not even our thoughts. Maybe it's this, maybe it's the fact that we judge ourselves and others and all of our experience. It's good, it's bad, it's me, it's mine. What if we didn't have any of this? What if we didn't have any judgment? What if we were never partial to anything or identified with anything? What if we just saw seeing as seeing, hearing as hearing, feeling as feeling, thinking as thinking? Would we be happy then? Well, let's take a look. So when we like things, we say to ourselves, liking, liking. We dislike things, disliking, disliking. We feel afraid, we say afraid, afraid. Let's learn about what's really going on here. What's it really like? When we're worried, we say to ourselves, worried, worried. Confused, confused. Distracted, distracted. Doubting, doubting. Shouldn't take long and you'll begin to see that really reality is something quite simple, and you start to wonder how you managed to get so complicated. How could we ever get so complicated? How could our lives get so complicated with such a simple thing? And your mind naturally inclines to a more straightforward way of life. One where you just see things as they are. One where you just live without having to be something, without having to obtain anything. Without needing anything, without wanting anything. You live a life free, free as a bird flying through the sky. It's a half an hour. You're all welcome to continue meditating if you like, or ask questions as you like. I'm going to start answering questions if there are any, and if they're not, I'll just keep meditating as well. Okay, I don't like to answer questions about myself. There's certain things that I'm not allowed to say, so better just keep that whole range of questions out of it. But if you want to know, how do I suggest one overcomes doubt? There's actually a list. I mean, I can go by the book. I could get you the book and give you the list of things that help you overcome doubt. It's in the commentary of the Satipatthana Sutta. Why don't we go through it? Because, you know, that way I don't make any mistakes, and then I can comment it on it from my own point of view. Let me just get this up. The hindrances. Right. Wrong reflection on things which are founded on doubt brings about the arising of doubt. Things which are founded on doubt are known as just doubt, owing to the state of being the reason of doubt again and again. Therefore, the Blessed One said that wrong reflection on things founded on doubt is the condition for fresh doubt and for the increase and expansion of doubt already arisen. By right reflection on wholesome things, karmically and the like, there is the casting out of doubt. That's a good point, because karma has a lot to do with doubt. And that's actually in the Visuddhimagga, it's in the book, the Visuddhimagga, it's considered to be the overcoming of doubt when you understand karma, when you understand cause and effect. So what karma means, it's the cause and effect relationship between body and mind. I think a big part of people's doubt is that they don't really understand karma at all, and they, in fact, can misunderstand karma, hearing of it as something like you kill people in this life and you die, you get killed in the next life, that kind of thing. That's not what karma means at all. Karma is the intentions that you have in the mind which have ethical consequences. They change you. And you can see that from a meditation Through meditation, you can see that. Therefore, the Blessed One said that right reflection on things which are karmically wholesome and not, things blameful and blameless, things to be practiced and not to be practiced. When you reflect upon what should be practiced and what shouldn't be practiced, you lose your doubt on it, about it. When you study it, I don't think reflect. When you study wholesome and unwholesome states, you come to see what is truly useful and what is harmful, what is useless. And then you don't have any doubt. See, once you see for yourself, you have no reason to doubt. Things low and high value, things dark and fair, the counterparts of bad and good, done intensely, keeps out fresh doubt and casts out doubt that has already come into existence. I believe this is a quote from somewhere in the suttas. Sounds familiar. There are these six things which help to throw out doubt. The state of being learned in the Buddha's teaching, so knowing a lot, when you study, the more you study the Buddha's teaching, I don't know, if you're not practicing, it's not so so useful. So being learned in the Buddha's teaching doesn't just mean studying, it means having experienced it as well, having thoroughly investigated it with your own practice. Inquiring about the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, so having a teacher who can answer your questions, this is a great way to overcome doubt. If you have questions about the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, when you ask about it, this helps to overcome doubt. Understanding thoroughly the nature of the discipline of morality, precepts. Why do we keep the five precepts? Why do we keep the eight precepts? Why do monks keep this or that precept? Of being decided about the truth of the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. So when you understand, when you realize that the Buddha's teaching is the truth, if you realize it's untruth, then that's something else. But perhaps once you practice, you start to realize that it is the truth. That would be what I would expect. And then you overcome doubt. Sympathetic and helpful companionship, being associated with people who are helpful and sympathetic, people who encourage you when you're discouraged, who restrain you when you're out of line, people who keep your mind, who help you, help remind you of what needs to be done and what must not be done, and keep you on track. These are good people to hang out with. And stimulating talk that helps to dispel doubt. So how do you overcome doubt? Well, all of the above are good, but the only way to overcome doubt is, as the Visuddhimagga says, it's called Kankavitarana. Kankavitarana Visuddhi, purification by overcoming doubt, is the realization of Paccayabarigahanyana, which is the second of the 16 jnanas. It's the knowledge of cause and effect. When you start to see that body and mind don't just work together in random ways, they don't just arise randomly. Good things lead to good things, bad things lead to bad things. Certain things can only lead to a certain type of result, and certain other things lead to a completely different result. You mentioned that karma is the intention of the mind. Can you explain that further? Right, this is something that many people have never even heard, which is a real shame, because the Buddha actually denied the law of karma. Surprise, surprise. Karma was a teaching from Hinduism that there are certain acts that are karmically potent. When you do this or do that, it magically has some result, or intrinsically is something that is pleasing to the gods, or other certain acts are displeasing to the gods and therefore are going to get you into or keep you out of heaven, which should sound familiar for Judeo-Christian people with a Judeo-Christian religious background. The Buddha denied this. He said, no, sorry, actions are not karmically potent, are not potent. Actions don't have this. Doesn't matter whether God likes it or not. You only cause suffering because of your own mind. Cetanahang bhikkave kamang vadami. It is cetana, or intention, O monks, which I call karma. So the Buddha denied karma. He said, it's actually your intention. When you intend, you act. All of our actions are based on intentions. Whether we speak, if suppose we say something nasty to someone, it's only karmically potent because we meant to say something nasty to them. It's only karmically potent because of the effect it has on our minds. It changes us. It sullies the mind. It makes us less pure or less less nice. I don't know. It makes us an all-around rotten. More and more rotten, the more evil we do. That's what brings the fruit. That's why when you die, you go according to your karma. You don't go according to your deeds. You go according to your state of mind. He did deny karma because karma means action. He denied that actions are of any consequence. It's the intentions behind the action. So he called that karma, but it's the actual intention that is karma. The act has nothing to do with it. If you sit around wanting to kill people, if you sit around intending to kill people but never get around to doing it, that's karma according to Buddhism. You still go to hell, whether you kill or not. The thing about actually killing is that it takes a lot more intention, sustained over a long period of time. And the word intention may not be the perfect translation of jetana, because once you kill, there is also the effect that has on your mind. And it's not really intention, but it's the mental quality of remorse and so on. When someone yells at you, just the fact that you don't like it is already karma, from a point of view of Buddhism. It has nothing to do with action. When you don't like something that someone else says to you, that's karma. And when you like something that someone else says or does to you, that's also karma. So the meaning isn't karma at all, it's actually intention. It's just we use the same word as Hinduism, because in Hinduism there was this idea that this was something that was potent, had an effect both in this life and in the next life, and so we use the same word to mean something totally different, which actually doesn't mean action anymore. So karma is just a state of mind. Lots of stuff here. Karma is just a state of mind. Yeah, that's maybe a really good way of putting it. There are not all states of mind are karmically potent. Some states of mind are innocuous. But those states of mind that are karmically potent are karma in and of themselves. On that note, how does karma affect future rebirths? Well, there's no such thing as birth and death. These are concepts. The mind arises and ceases every moment, and so it simply goes according to that. The body is like a wave crashing against the shore. When it crashes, another wave starts. It's just a very contrived and complex organization of experience that is patterned and habitual. The human form is something that we've cultivated over millions and millions of years. And so it arises and ceases, but actually the mind just continues on based on its inclination. Now, at the moment of death, a lot of new stuff can happen. Because of the complexity and the intensity of the human state, it prevents a lot of change from occurring suddenly. So your karma doesn't have the same effect. When you die, quote-unquote die, at that moment, you're free from all of that complexity for just a short time. And so that allows you to be born, for example, in heaven and hell, for things to change quite radically, because it's a moment where you make a decision to create. If you don't change your mind hardly at all in this life, you'll come back as a human. That's pretty simple. But if you change your mind a lot at the moment of death, there's the chance for that new mind to lead you somewhere else. And then intending murder but acting in a helpful manner is bad karma. I guess so, yeah. I mean, is it possible to intend murder and then act in a helpful manner? Yeah, if you help people with very, very bad intentions, you're still sullying your mind, totally. It has nothing to do with your actions. Except for the fact that if you are helping people, there's probably some little good intention in there. So that's probably a good karma as well. Having good intentions brings you to do good deeds and brings you good results and happy feelings, right? Right. Yep. How do you deal with pain? I mean, physical chronic pain. Yeah. Well, the best way is to learn about it, is to understand it. Especially when it's chronic, you've got a perfect opportunity to study something that most of us spend all our lives chasing or running away from. So you take the opportunity to learn about pain and come to see that it's actually just pain. It's not bad or good or me or mine. It comes and it goes. If you think about it for a second, why is pain bad? There's really no reason to see it as bad. Just that alone should reassure us in this sort of activity. And as you look at it, you'll start to let go, you'll start to dislike it less. In the beginning, you'll just dislike it more. You're like, why am I looking at this? But then you see that this disliking is the real cause of suffering, and you naturally start to let it go when you see that it's causing you suffering. And you realize that the pain's not really a problem at all. So the method, technically speaking, is to remind yourself that it's only pain, saying to yourself, pain, pain, pain. Pain wakes me up at night. Well, yeah, that's great. If you're up at night, that's great. You've got lots more time to meditate. So just stay up all night saying pain, pain, and so on. I mean, of course, it's not great. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make little of your difficulty, but you've got it. I can't take it away from you. And you can't get rid of it either. If you try to run away from it, you only create more and more aversion. So the best thing is to start to think like this. To be comfortable with it. Okay, I'm going to be woken up at night, fine, I'll meditate all night. It actually is quite peaceful if you meditate all night and get up in the morning actually quite rested. Or you really suck at doing evil, yeah, that's well said. If you mean to do lots of evil things and actually wind up doing good deeds. It's another defilement because you can't even do that right. No, I don't know about that. If your intention is murder, then do you not attract similar thinking people, and then to help them is not really helping humanity? Yeah, I mean, it's not intellectual, it's moment to moment. Every moment that you help someone, that's a good karma. Every moment that you... that you intend to help someone. So you have to get this exact. Every moment that you intend to hurt someone, that's a bad karma. And so both of those are going to affect you in good or bad ways every single moment that they arise. So what is the Buddhist version of heaven and hell? It's a lot like the Christian version, except it's not permanent. It arises and it ceases, just like everything else. It arises based on the power of collective karma. So if all your life you're full of hate, you're cultivating that, and that's going to have some repercussions. If all your life you cultivate love and etc., good states, then it's going to have an effect in the opposite direction. It's not easy to go to heaven or hell. You have to do a lot of bad stuff or good stuff, or just have really intense bad or good experience, bad or good mind states. Is life permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Do ghosts exist? Sounds like some of the questions that don't lead to edification. Why do you want to know these things? Are they going to help you in your practice? Are they going to make you more happy and more at peace? Then you should acknowledge wanting, because I don't answer all questions. If you help someone else who also intends to hurt someone, you're not really helping, right? No, I disagree with that, actually. Because consider, karma has nothing, because it's only intention and how it affects your mind, it has nothing to do with the recipient, except insofar as that affects your intention. If you know someone is going to do bad deeds and you help them thinking they'll be able to do more bad deeds, then yes, you're not really going to have a good karma as a result. That thought is not going to, or that mind state is not going to purify your mind. But if you help someone thinking, oh, this person's hungry, and then because of eating the food, without even thinking about it, you don't realize, but because of eating that food, they go and kill someone, or they have the power to fight, or to kill, or to rob, or to, you know, do all sorts of raping and pillaging, or whatever. You're not responsible, and you're not, it doesn't affect you karmically. Of course, the other aspect is that your mind doesn't leap out at helping evil people. It doesn't make you think, yes, this is a great thing. Your mind doesn't become pure and clear by helping evil people, because they're not very, they're not very inspiring. So if you help wise and kind people, it's much more inspiring and uplifting for the mind. But this question always arises in regards to helping beggars on the street, etc., because you think, well, they're just going to maybe go buy alcohol with it or drugs or whatever. It's not really important, but clearly that's going to affect the intentions in your mind. It's not something you should worry about, but it is something you should consider. If I help this person, is it going to really bring peace to my mind? I heard you before talking on taking care of parents. Can you please explain more? Yeah, taking care of parents is wonderful. It's something that is definitely good karma. There's a lot of good karma. This is where we understand that it's not actions, because it can also be very bad karma. Sometimes taking care of your parents leads to a lot of anger. You know? So you're trying to help them, but because of our intense relationship with them, we wind up getting angry at them, and they wind up getting angry at us, and we might get sick of helping them and feel like we're being used and so on. Maybe we feel like we're wasting our time, or that we're giving more to them than they ever gave to us, for example. Maybe we help them very little, thinking that they didn't help us, or thinking that rationalizing in our minds, see, because it, in order to side, what's it? In order to side with ourselves, we reassure ourselves that they don't really need the help. And so we don't want to we don't want to lose our own pleasure in life. You know, we don't want to be imposed upon. So we pretend, oh, they don't really need our help, and so we put them in an old age home and so on. Which is a problem. Lama, you've got your... Oh, he can't hear us, I guess. He's got his voice on. Can someone tell him to turn off his speaking? He's we're hearing voices in this background. But you know, so love for your parents is much more important than helping them. In fact, this is the case in all your relationships. It doesn't matter what you do. It matters how your mind stays, because that's going to affect your that's going to influence all of your acts. So, you know, mindfulness helps. This is why meditation is so important, because you don't have to think, what will I do in this situation? What will I do in that situation? When you're mindful, when you're clearly aware of the situation, you act according to wisdom. So Lama's having trouble with his audio. I don't know, he's got a dot above his head, so everything's working. It's probably a hardware problem. Probably something's not plugged in, or volume's turned way down, or something like that. No, I think he's got some volume turned down, or something's unplugged or something. Right, but helping a drug cartel by selling them arms would not be right. Yes, indeed. Well, selling them arms wouldn't be a good deed anyway, because you're not giving you're making money off of it. It's not a good deed to sell people things. But if you give him the guns, well, still not a very good deed now, is it? Second life is one of the never-ending issues, is these technical difficulties. No sound. That's good for teaching patience. I'm sure Lama is having a great lesson, great meditation on patience right now. I know how that is. Does not taking that which is freely given mean you should not buy and sell? No, it certainly doesn't. When you buy and sell, it's given with conditions. You know, if this, then that. If you give me this, I will give you that. So as long as you fulfill those conditions, you're taking what is. The word freely you've added in there. It's nothing. The precept doesn't have the word freely in it. Adina dana just means taking what is not given. So as long as it's given, no matter what the conditions are, and you fulfill those conditions, then it's not against that precept. If you don't fulfill the conditions, someone's selling something and you don't pay for it, then I would say yes, you're fulfilling the conditions for stealing. What happens to a person if he simply is striving to be the best person he can? Will that bring him forward on the way towards enlightenment? Yeah, provided that the best person he can is the same meaning that the Buddha would place on it, right? Because if he thinks being the best person he can is by disciplining his children and following the teachings of this or that religion outside of the Buddha's teaching, then no. No, that would lead him away from enlightenment. But if you mean goodness, like if it's truly goodness, then absolutely. Right. But I guess there is the question of whether simple goodness is enough to lead you to enlightenment. It's not by itself enough, but certainly it's beneficial. If you help people, if you're kind to people, it makes your mind clearer, it makes your mind calmer, it makes it easier to practice meditation. It's not in and of itself enough to just be a good person. You won't become enlightened that way, but certainly is a helpful base. A lot of people come to practice meditation and have difficulty because they're always feeling guilty about bad deeds they've done. They're always being distracted by all of their greeds and desires and so on. So people who are able to give up their desires and aversions conceptual level, you know, like giving up their possessions or giving away things or being content and so on, all of this will support you in the meditation. It's a good foundation. It's a warning to people. If you're doing lots of bad deeds, meditation will be very difficult for you. You have to try your best to avoid evil deeds before meditating. Or avoid them in general, because they lead to guilt and suffering and so on. Why is it not enough by itself? Because enlightenment requires wisdom. Wisdom doesn't just come from doing good deeds. Wisdom comes from clearing your mind, from understanding your mind, from studying reality. If that were the case, then we'd all have been enlightened. We've all done good deeds before. I suppose that's simplistic to say. Most of us don't do purely good deeds. I know I've given talks before. There's seven pathways. There's seven different paths you can take, and one of them is the path of goodness. But goodness doesn't by itself lead to enlightenment. Yes, goodness leads to heaven. Thank you, dude. Who's this dude guy? He seems like a pretty cool guy to me. Hey. We can spy on each other because we've got everyone's profiles. Ah, here's a good guy. Yes. I am Buddhist. Hello, dude. The only way to get to know who you guys really are is by reading your profiles, and even then it only gives me the idea of what sort of things you would write on your profiles. So that's it. No, not so many questions. Good. We're not a very skeptical crowd. Or maybe you're all just chatting with each other or something. Checking out Facebook while I talk. Maybe you've all already left. These are just your avatars. Best timing is to do meditation. I can spend 1.5 hours weekday on meditation. Do you suggest splitting the time? Yeah, I mean, there's no hard and fast rule, but it's nice to be able to do some in the morning and some in the evening, because morning meditation prepares you for the day, and even meditation clears out all the garbage that you've collected during the day, or files it all if it's not garbage. So they both have their benefits. And not just having their benefits, it means you're going to be more mindful in between. If there's the more time there is in between meditations, the more you lose your mindful habit. So if you do it twice a day, that's only 12 hours or whatever, however many hours in between. It's a lot less. But don't try to set goals that are hard and fast. A good goal is to, you know, be practicing every day. If some days you do less or some days you do more, that's not really the issue. And it's better not to beat yourself up about it. But try to do at least some practice every day. And maybe it's only in the evening some days, maybe it's only in the morning some days. But if you set it as, you know, the ideal is twice a day, something like that, then whether you hit it every day or not is not really an issue. Just keep that as your ideal and should be okay. Of course, trying to be mindful during the time in between, because meditation has to become a habit, has to change your way of looking at things. It has to be habitual. if for some reason if I don't do meditation day, the next is much harder. Is that normal? Yeah, that's sort of what I was saying, is that you lose the habit. You know, we're trying to get into a groove. We're trying to cultivate the habit of mindfulness. When you don't meditate, then you start to slip. Your mind starts to incline in other directions. This is why practicing as often as you can is the best, and practicing in between times is of great support as well, because it keeps you in the groove, keeps you on track. I guess maybe I'll just stop there. So maybe we can just stop the session there. If anyone wants to talk, I'm still available afterwards. I'd like to thank you all for coming. I hope that this has been useful, that some of the things that you've heard and some of the answers you've gotten are a benefit in your own practice, on your path to find peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. May all of you, all of us, all of beings in existence become free from suffering. May all beings find peace, happiness. May all beings find bliss. Sadhu, and thank you for coming.